You're listening to the Podcast Detroit Network. Visit www.podcastdetroit.com for more information. From Detroit, the city that turbocharged America. This is the Mustard and Onions podcast, dedicated to everything that makes the Motor City the most interesting city in the world. Connect with us on Twitter and Facebook. We're at Mustard Podcast. I'm your co-host, Mark Pants, speaking to you from the alcohol-friendly studios of Podcast Detroit, with music presented by the Infatuations and beer presented by the Falling Down Beer Company. And now, here's the host of Mustard and Onions, Mr. Jim Bolella.
Thank you, Mark Pants, and welcome everybody to another Detroit-filled edition of Mustard and Onions. I am Jim Bolella, and Mark, I got into the studio today to start setting up for the show, and I couldn't help but hear your unmistakable voice in the very next room on another podcast of a different name.
Oh, well, I hate to cheat on you and double time. You know, but there's no soundproofing in the world that will prevent my voice from leaking through. And I was on the Top Rope Review podcast. They are all about professional wrestling, local wrestling, the big stuff. And WrestleMania weekend was last week. So they asked me to come on and promote a show that I'm involved with, and as well as give my ideas about WrestleMania. And it was a lot of fun, and I really enjoyed hanging out with the guys.
So who's hosting? I noticed a bunch. It was like a clown car, like 10 people piled out of that room when the show was over. Who's hosting over there?
So we've got Josh is the host of the show. Normally Will the Wookiee from the Ninja Podcast show is also part of it, but he's in Pittsburgh or Philadelphia. I forget. Tabitha, Joe, Mike, it's a group of guys who love wrestling.
Yeah.
They love local wrestling as well. And they have a great show. So, I mean, if you are interested in pro wrestling, and I know that's kind of a niche, but I'm sure
Yes and no. I mean, wrestling's huge. I mean, you're either in or you're out, you know. But if you're in, you're not part of a small, niche group, I don't think.
Not anymore. You know, it used to be kind of a thing like – well, you know – actually, maybe not, because I remember my dad talking about my grandma going to go see the roller derby, or she would go to see Gorgeous George, and she talked about how terrible he was. And you know, it was more of a thing for a more adult crowd to boo. You know, like Gorgeous George, the Sheik of Detroit. I don't know if you've ever heard of.
I have.
Yeah. So, I mean, like, you know, he'd take that pencil and he'd dig it in Dick the Bruiser's eyeball and whatnot.
I grew up on that stuff.
Right. So, you know? It's funny because, you know, what is entertainment of the past is the entertainment of the future. And the WWE is a huge publicly traded company right now.
Yeah. Well, it's a little puzzling to me because I remember as a kid in Detroit, watching on Sunday morning, you had wrestling and you had oftentimes some boxing and roller derby. And roller derby has come back, not as big as wrestling, but I mean, right. It sort of like went away. And now cities all over the country have roller derby teams where you can go watch girls punch each other in the face and roller skate.
Roller derby used to be more gender inclusive, actually. For whatever reason, now in its new incarnation, it's more female. That's okay. I don't mind.
It seems to be all female.
Yes.
And that's what I remember as a kid on Sunday mornings. It was women. But there was – I mean, it's not like roller ball with James Caan.
No. People go home at the end of the day if they're roller derby performers. I shouldn't say performers because the weird thing is roller derby – this is kind of funny because back in the day, wrestling was sport that was boring and became entertainment. So wrestling – professional wrestling is as old as boxing or anything else. But – the thing is, a match takes a long time between two really, really good competitors.
Well, again, the way they do it, I mean, it's just that the collegiate wrestling, because I wrestled for years in junior high and high school, and you have time limits. It's like you have 3 2-minute session, 2 minute periods. So 6 minutes, match is over. But wrestling, oldest, I mean, right. This is like one of the oldest sports because this started with the Greek Olympics from day one.
Right.
But somehow it went from.
Well, they found out that they'd sell more tickets if they kind of like nudge the story, you know, and then that became a little and I don't think I'm speaking out of school when I say that wrestling is fixed.
I don't think you're out of school.
OK.
No.
All right. They call it kayfabe. You're supposed to maintain it. But yeah, like so wrestling became a thing that was fixed and maybe early on that would have been a problem for the audience. But it became more entertaining. You know, you get guys like throwing another guy at the ropes. Well, I've been thrown at things. You know, you can look at my face and see that I've been in a scrap or two, but I would never bounce back and return to the person, you know, who threw me at him. So yeah, like there's been a lot of liberties taken in the world of pro wrestling and we just kind of like, you know, go, yeah, that's okay. It's more fun to watch a fixed fight. And let's be honest, when you watch Die Hard, you don't go like, oh, it's fake, you know.
Right, right.
You know, there's a lot of great things in wrestling. There's a lot of really athletic performers and a lot of creativity. So is wrestling a soap opera? Yeah. Is it something that's kind of Americana? Yeah, totally. You know, here it is, and it's probably not going anywhere for a long time. In fact, it's actually growing.
Yeah, if it's made it this far, because and I know regular, you know, collegiate style wrestling, it is boring if you don't know anything about it.
Right.
And a lot of people are not going to take the time to learn. They just look, and it's two guys just kind of pushing on each other, and they're like, "Oh man, this is so dull." And I can understand why somebody said, "What if we took this and flipped it upside down?" It's like curling.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of people don't want to watch curling, but when they start learning about it and they go, oh, actually, this is kind of cool. And if you live in Michigan or if you live in Southeast Michigan, where as a kid, you know, before cable, you could get Channel 9 from Windsor and you could
see Olympic coverage, by the way. CBC.
Oh, the CBC, yeah.
CBC does a great job in the Olympics.
So. Yeah. So as Detroiters, you know, since we're practically part of Canada and vice versa, we get exposed to that stuff. And you'll flick on Channel 9 and you know you're watching stuff that other people can't watch. And it feels like I got special TV. I can watch what's going on in Canada. Yeah. Hey, we see curling at my house. And you go to other parts of the state or go to other states, they never heard of it. It's like, yeah, because you don't have Detroit. You know, you don't have the Windsor connection that we have in Detroit. So I get it. But I thought. You know, because boxing has been crushed by MMA.
Mm-hmm.
Why didn't that happen to wrestling?
Well,
because MMA is not fake.
I'll tell you,
you're really trying to murder someone,
right? Right. As somebody who enjoys MMA to a degree and loves watching those classic boxing matches, I'll watch an Ali, you know, match. I'll watch, especially if Howard Cosell is announcing. I will always tune in, but. With MMA, there's a lot of that ground game stuff that I know is significant. I know it's important, but it doesn't speak to me. I can't tell who's the aggressor. Like when I see an MMA guy, you know, turtle on his back and be like, come get me, you know, like this. Like to me, like that's boring. Like Pride out of Japan was an MMA where the referees would make the guys get up. They'd be like, you have to stand up and let's fight, put up your dukes and do it like that. And that I could enjoy and appreciate as a casual fan. But if you don't know, like my high school didn't have wrestling. If it did, I would have given it a go. But I don't know like the takedowns sometimes. I don't know when somebody's scoring and when – especially growing up watching Ric Flair put people in the figure four, which has never made anybody tap out, by the way.
No, it's not. And it's really not designed for that. That was the funny thing for me because I knew actual wrestling as a kid and I would watch the pro wrestling on TV and say, well, they've taken some of the stuff that we've learned and just perverted it completely and just twisted it to something that – I'm like, wow, because the – you know, like you hear about the souple, or they call it the suplex, I guess. We used to call it the souple when I was in wrestling. But that was illegal because, you know, if the person landed wrong, you could break their neck. You know, so it was technically – it was a move, and I'm going to get into the weeds here just briefly. It was a move that I think is legal in Greco-Roman wrestling. Greco-Roman wrestling is real wrestling, but the thing is there is no – you can't attack your opponent's legs and try and take them down. It's all upper body throws. So you're right. Grabbing somebody by the neck like in a headlock and then trying to hurl them over your back. The suplex works. You know, you grab them and try and toss them backwards and have them land on their head. It's wild. It's really wild, but it's also extremely difficult. So right. that's not going to be a TV favorite either.
That reminds me of judo, which comes from jiu-jitsu, which every move I understand is meant to kill. Yeah. So judo is the nerfed version of that, where you don't die when you practice it. I guess that's a good thing. I've never done Greco-Roman, but that would make a lot of sense, and that would also be for a Roman audience, probably more entertaining to watch. Yeah,
it seems like a Colosseum kind of stuff.
Yeah.
It would be. But so anyway, let's spin this back around local. Mark, yep. you're talking about your personal involvement in a local wrestling event. What's that about?
Right. Well, I can guarantee you that nobody's life is in danger.
Excellent.
At the event I'm working, or a person who looks a lot like me and sounds a lot like me will be emceeing and doing play-by-play for. And that is the Squared Circle Review. The Squared Circle Review is kind of a wild hodgepodge mix of circus, music, and wrestling in one. While the wrestlers are performing, there's live music played to the match. And we also have characters that are very, very different. We have for instance, we have Sal Silk. And he has the smoothest legs in professional wrestling. So if you were to try and put him in a Boston Crab or maybe a figure four leg lock, woe to you, my friend, because he would slip right out.
Wow. That's his superpower.
Yes.
And smooth legs.
We have Invisibil. He's the only invisible Playboy wrestler that we've ever known. And his voice is remarkably similar to mine with a Latin accent.
But he's invisible.
He is invisible. Yes.
Wow.
We have Baby Gaga, who is the world's only wrestling baby. And he is accompanied to the ring by his manager, the Mamarazzi. And this year somebody much like me will be hosting a little mini show in the match that will determine who the father of Baby Gaga is.
Wow. So there's a Maury Povich angle.
There very much is. And we also have the Wheel of Time, which has been a popular aspect of our shows. And the Wheel of Time is a big giant wheel that you spin and click, 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 you know, like Price is Right or mm-hmm. whatnot. And – 1 year it landed on the future of Ferndale. Ferndale 2027, I believe it was. And who descended from the mist of this time-traveling wheel was the Brobot, the cybernetic douchebag from the future. Yes.
So douchebags do survive into the future.
Very much, and they're cybernetically enhanced. So much so that he likes to party all the time. And he he's known to use Axe body spray in the eyes of his opponents.
Oh my!
To damage them, he has a manager called the Hobot, who I'm not going to get in the weeds with that one. She's a very nice girl, I'm sure. But anyway, this is his spring break bash. He's been such a hit with the fans, and we've decided to celebrate him with his Bro Vodka brand that he's brought back from the future. So if you come on down to the Tangent Gallery over on Milwaukee Street in Detroit, it's Friday the 14th. Plenty of time for you guys to get your tickets. You'll have a lot of laughs, and you'll have a lot of fun watching Brobot host his spring break batch and bash. And I will call those batches.
Designer douchebag vodka. That is interesting.
Yes. Don't. You might not want to put it into a bong or anything like that. It is very powerful. It is futuristic. Yes. But it will be available for a reasonable price.
So what you're saying is, I guess the human liver will have evolved by 2027 to be able to handle Bro Vodka. Might be a little strong for people in this time, right. On this timeline.
I mean, I don't claim to be a doctor or anything like that, but I would imagine that some sort of like little cybernetic bugs. You can swallow those and they will help, you know, break down the
toxins. Digestive nanobots that would help you metabolize
nanobots.
Bro vodka. Yeah, of course. Well, what else would it be?
Yeah, I just put you on the list. I'll need that kind of insight.
So. All right, well, let's switch gears a little bit to focus on some Detroit stuff. Since we don't have a guest today, we thought we would do this every so often where you and I can just sort of talk about what's going on a macro level in Detroit. And, you know, when we have a guest, we sort of zoom in on one person and their experience and what they're doing. So I wanted to start talking about this latest census data for Wayne County. They were talking about, you know, the Freep had an article about this earlier this week saying, well, how do we talk about Detroit's success? I mean, we feel all these good things going on, but, you know, what are the metrics? And one of the metrics they said, you know, and this is really because of Duggan, because Duggan has said many times, my metric for the success of Detroit is going to be when we start growing again instead of losing population. Well, it doesn't look like that's going to happen just yet.
Right.
We're still losing a lot of people. We're losing more than are coming in.
I've seen those numbers.
Yeah. It's I'm not shocked by that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm not surprised by that really at all. You know, first of all, when you start flipping things over, when you start putting up high-tech companies downtown, well, that's not going to be any advantage to the people that live in the neighborhoods of Detroit. They're not trained for those jobs, and they can't afford the debt to go to college to even learn how to do some of those jobs.
Right.
So we're still going to lose a bunch of those people who are still not going to find any opportunity. You know, again, the factory jobs are not there and they're not coming back. So all of those people that were displaced by the auto industry, they're still going to probably have to move to another state somewhere else to find work. Detroit's not going to do it for them. So we're not there yet. That whole transition hasn't taken place yet. And some people that were hopeful that things were changing, it's like, yeah, things are changing, but we've talked about it before, not for the people in those neighborhoods. If you're not in Midtown and if you don't have a degree in high tech something or other, or if you're not qualified to work at Quicken Loans or Blue Cross Blue Shield, you're kind of out of luck.
Yeah. And it's also one of the flaws of these reports is simply that, you know, these things aren't overnight. Like, you can't judge a turnaround in 3 months. You can't judge a turnaround in 6 months. You know, a lot of times you have to sit there and wait to see the results. Now this one, you know, it's people leaving. That's not a good thing, obviously. But, you know, a lot of the flaws of American politics, in my opinion, is simply that people expect immediate results.
Yeah.
And that's just kind of like the nature of human beings. We've got to the point where, like, we can do a lot of things. We can do banking. We can do this. We can do that. And we instantly get gratification. We instantly get results, and we can measure those in the real time. However, when it comes to these big things, when it comes to quality of life, when it comes to, you know, population growth and stuff like that, like, these are all decisions that people were making more than the most recent 3 months, more than the most recent 6 months or so. They were probably leaving, you know, regardless, or maybe they were forced to. It's just tough to be so immediate with these kind of
it's been said many times, it's going to take a generation to flip a city like Detroit over.
Right.
And in the meantime, so Duggan has kind of hung his hat on that metric. He's saying, and remember, when he got into office, he made a plea to people. He said, if you're thinking about leaving, give me 6 months.
Right.
You're going to see change. You know, like you said, he knew people, if people don't see something soon, they're going to go, it's more of the same crap. I'm out of here.
Right.
And he said, trust me, we're going to get the buses running again. We're going to get the streetlights fixed. We're going to get more cops. We're going to figure this out, because it's not all going to happen overnight. But I'm telling you, within 6 months, you're going to see change. You can actually sort of feel.
Right.
And he did make some of those changes. He did, you know, the streetlights are fixed and the buses are running better than ever, better than they have in decades. And that doesn't pay anyone's rent.
Mm-hmm.
And also, for those people in Detroit that were doing better, who did find some opportunity, as soon as they started making some money, they left the city. They went to the burbs.
Right.
So Detroit – and you know what that has done? So as a result of that, now poverty, the percentage of people living in poverty in Detroit is even worse than it was a year or two ago. And you think, oh my God, how can that be true? Well, again, people with money aren't living there. And if they start to make a little money, they get out as soon as possible. They're clearly not believing in it yet.
Yeah. Well, let's not forget that if you live in the city, you get a tax that even if you don't work in the city, you get a city tax at the end of the year. And people are thinking about that right now. And if you do work in the city and live in the city, you get I think it's about a 3% total tax. So, you know, it's tough for people. Like, I mean, 3%, you know, that's a small number. But, you know, at the end of the day, year after year, that's tough. And that's as high as it can go. It might be higher if they were allowed to by the state. And I understand why they do it, because people are leaving and people have been leaving. That number hasn't changed in my lifetime that I'm aware. But that's a significant like little raise you can give yourself if you move to, you know, Westland, or if you move to Ferndale or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, 3%, you know, makes a lot of difference for people who are struggling, you know, if you're
absolutely
at that low level.
Yeah. I mean, if you're working at Quicken Loans or one of the high tech companies downtown or Blue Cross Blue Shield, you're not worried about it too much. But for all those people that are, you know, still just making ends meet, like all those people that are hooked up with the Time Bank, we had our guest from the Time Bank on a few weeks ago. And so many people in Detroit are just barely, you know, they're working, but they're part of the working poor. They're working a job, maybe two jobs, and just being able to pay for rent and food. And when anything else goes wrong, they don't have money left over for that. That extra 3% would make a difference to them. Not to mention, as you've talked about before, the car insurance rate is ridiculous. Right. I mean, you cannot afford that on most of the jobs that are left. I mean, again, if you're part of that renaissance in Midtown, you're fine. Mm-hmm. But even those people, even those millennials with those jobs, they're trying to avoid having to buy a car.
Right. And if they buy a cool car, woe to them. I mean, like if they buy a car with any kind of, you know, get up and go behind it, they will and they're honest about where they live, they will find out real fast what the insurance companies think about where they live. And I recently read something that was kind of funny, because it was it said that there's not a lot of difference between the car theft rates or the fraud rates between more suburban cities and more urban cities. And yet there was that big gap. I don't have it in front of me, so I'm kind of shy to even mention it. But I read it this week, and it really made me sad that if it's true that the insurance companies are kind of taking advantage of the fact that people live in a city who with a dangerous quote unquote, you know, reputation. And that's a real bummer, because imagine, you know, if you 20% off your insurance, I mean, my insurance personally is more than my car payment.
Yeah.
You know, not by a lot. I mean, it's not like the end of the world or anything like that. I'm okay. Don't send, you know, Kickstarter for me, but, but I'm not happy about it. It's pardon me. It fucking sucks. And you know, and that's the way it is.
Yeah. Well, I've talked about that too. I mean, in probably 2 years, I will have paid more in insurance than my entire car is worth.
Right.
And I don't live in Detroit, but I mean, that's just the way it goes. And I wish they called me while I was in the car. I got a call from my insurance company because my 6 month big payments come and due, and they want to say, well, we want to make sure that all your needs are being met, you know, see if we need to make any adjustments, because I have my homeowners and my car insurance with the same company. And I said, look, I'm in the car right now. It's not a good time to talk about this. I said, but call me tomorrow, which they didn't, because I wanted to say, because I wanted to tell them, because I love to hear their reaction when I say, because they'll say, well, we just want to make sure that all your needs are being met. You got the right amount of insurance for everything. And I'm like, well, I'm glad you asked, because you know what? You guys are going – you're sucking so much plasma out of me that the entire – if I ram my car into a tree, manage to survive but completely wreck the car, you guys still come out ahead on the money you've made off me, because I'm paying you way more. And like if I had a $30,000 car, my rates might be a little bit higher, but not that much. You know how this works.
Mm-hmm.
And If I get into a wreck, they would be replacing a $30,000 car, not a $3,000 car.
Right,
and I'm like,
right.
How can my rates be so close to those people that are driving cars that cost 10 times what my car cost?
Right.
So let's talk about a plan that costs something that's commensurate with the value of my car rather than a plan that serves your needs as an insurance company.
Right.
If you want to adjust my insurance, that would be the way to make adjustments for me based on what I'm driving, not whatever your executives want to be driving.
Yep. And for the audience, I want to let them know you drive one of the – I don't want to embarrass you further, but you drive one of the safest automobiles that's possible on the road. I mean, like, it's not like, you know, Jim's not driving around in a jalopy. He's not, you know, there's not pointy sticks coming out of the side.
No.
Or anything. It's not a Mad Max vehicle. It's a very, very safe vehicle.
It's a very old Volvo with almost 189,000 miles on it, which burns oil.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I don't know how much life is left in it. Those things go for a while. You know,
right.
It's a pretty well-made car. And I'm, you know, knock on wood, I think it's going to be around for a while. I'm thinking, how much insurance do I need? You know,
right.
For a car that's on its, you know, it might be on its last leg and doesn't cost very much to replace, yada, yada, yada.
Yeah.
And it's just that much worse for people that live in the city. That's another thing Duggan has talked about, he was going to address, was getting that sort of D insurance so people in the city could get a better deal. I honestly don't know where we are with that. It's obviously not close to being a reality. And I don't know how they would really pull that off, to be honest.
Yeah, it seems like you would need to have a big pool. You would have to start with a pre-existing insurance company, kind of piggyback off them. I don't know how you do that. And
I might be wrong here, but wouldn't this be unprecedented for a city to offer its residents its own insurance package?
I mean, outside of like Venezuela or something. I mean, like, I really don't know. Like, I mean, it seems pretty crazy.
I've never heard of that.
But the citizens of Detroit have been fleeced so bad that it doesn't sound crazy to somebody's ears that is like, yeah, I've been paying too much. But when you stop and look at it on paper, you're like, well, this will never happen.
Well, I don't. Yeah. I mean, let's be realistic. Don't you think that part of the issue is that because it's so expensive, there's tons of people in Detroit that just don't have car insurance.
Right. Well, there's a ton of people who have car insurance long enough to get their registration.
Right.
And there are companies that are complicit in that crime, and there's a lot of them in this town. There's a lot of funky businesses in this town. I've had jobs where I've gotten to drive up and down all sorts of streets of Detroit, and I've had a lot of laughs looking at some of the businesses and their storefronts because they're not exactly shy about it. It's getting a little bit less blatant, but you know there are. The first one I remember is in the back of Metro Times with Bob's photo ID, which was how a lot of kids at Wayne State got to drink.
Bob's photo ID.
Bob's photo ID. I bet there's a lot of people around my age that remember that name and have probably gone to Alvin's and a bunch of clubs that are since closed with their Bob's photo ID and had a good time. But, you know, there's also always been like the, you know, 2-week insurance. I might be wrong about the time frame, but there's always like that 3-day insurance. You'll be insured for 3 days. There's only one reason you would ever want such a product, and that's so you can go down to the old Secretary of State and be like, hey, look at this. I've got insurance. And they're like, well, how many days is it? It's like, well, tomorrow it'll still be
expires
good.
To what's the date today?
Right. You know, but a lot of states don't even have the no fault. So, you know, I don't claim to know the answer. But some states have no-fault insurance, and they seem to be running perfectly fine, and their gas is cheaper than ours. You know, like right now we're looking at some of the highest gas numbers in the state and a lot of our infrastructure and stuff like that is rolled into it. I don't know the answer for sure, but I know there's a lot of people working the system, and I know there's a lot of advertisements for people like Jeffrey Figer.
Yeah.
Mike Morris, I forget.
Oh, is that the Mike Wins guy?
Yeah, come Mike for the wins. Yeah.
So cheesy.
Yeah, I Wikipedia'd him. His sister, by the way, is a sex expert. fun fact. And then there's also the Bernsteins. So, yeah. I mean, we've got three. Oh, and don't forget about Jemana.
Jemana Cruz.
Yes. You know, what happened to baby? I haven't seen her commercials in a while, but she had some pretty good ones. So, I mean, those commercials don't pop up out of nowhere. You know, like those are
– yeah.
Those are a product of our system.
And they are – they advertise like mad on daytime television.
Oh, my gosh.
When
yes.
unemployed people are home watching the tube, we have a lot of unemployed people in Detroit. So I get it. And this is another reason that this culture is not going to flip quickly. You know, we have all these people that are still, regardless of the new businesses opening up and the, you know, the Illich Red Wing Center and all the great stuff that's happening. I mean, that still isn't going to touch most of the neighborhoods. And it's not going to bring jobs to those people who are unemployed, who have a factory skill mentality. I mean, they have, you know, we're not, other than I guess some of the refurbishing of some of the big buildings downtown, you know, I mean the call for electricians and carpenters and mechanics and things like that isn't greatly increasing. It's people that sit in front of a computer. That's what's increasing.
And as a bleeding heart liberal, there is a percentage of them, and I will admit it, that are just not interested. You know, like when you've got those chances to you know, when you've got Jeffrey Figer and stuff like that, you know, in front of you. Now, I'm not saying it's the vast majority, but there is a little bit of that, you know, human nature that will take the low road.
Oh, sure. I mean, you're gonna find that anywhere.
Yeah, but especially after a while of being out of it, I think maybe. But yeah, there's a lot of people preying also on those. I mean, gosh, I saw a commercial, a billboard commercial when I was downtown. Actually, it was near the Tangent Gallery where you can go and see the Squared Circle Review. And it was for a lawyer who was looking for asbestos claims for people who have actually scrapped homes. And it was
– yikes.
Yeah. You know, and like I said, I am as liberal as they come. And I was like, no. That ain't no good. I do not like. I want to hit the delete button on that, but it's the reality of society, unfortunately.
It is. Well, there is a little bit of a bright side, and the Freep talks about this too. So DTE has reported that the number of residential connections in the city went up by about 3,000 from, I think, last year to in a year's time, and it might have been 2015. So that means that there are more households, you know, functioning in the city. That's good. So we don't have the growth metric of population, but when you have an increase of DTE customers, that means that those are early indicators that things are going in the right direction for sure. The city's blight removal program, even though they've, you know, that we've talked about the fact that they had these cost overruns, they're being investigated, but you still have to look at the numbers, and they have knocked down 11,000 or more homes in the past couple of years. That's amazing. It's amazing progress. And when you start to get rid of that blight, you start to get rid of that rubble image, you know, the whole dilapidated post-apocalyptic city image that we're known for.
It's not just image. I mean, like, that's a place for people to operate.
Yeah, that too.
You know, and they do. So that's really great because that's where you find people like running houses of ill repute, you know, and maybe an exchange of products and goods that are not necessarily legal.
Yeah.
And if you can get rid of those, that's an excellent benchmark. So
yeah. And there's more good news. So the millennials, which we've just been talking about, in a 5-year span, there are 10,000 more millennials living in Detroit than there were 5 years ago.
Right.
Now, again, mostly high-tech jobs. But think about it. We've got – when was the last time you saw young people racing to downtown Detroit to live and work? That has not happened in our lifetime. It has not happened in the last 60 years. And the fact that it's happening at all and it's happening in these kind of numbers where in certain areas downtown, around Midtown, there are actually waiting lists for some housing.
Yeah.
Because so many people are going down there so fast.
Yeah. I'm a Gen Xer. And when I was doing it, people were like, what? Are you crazy? and no, that's a great sign. It's a great sign that there's more to come too, like, because they're setting up shop permanently. They're not just there for, you know, to kick the wheels or whatever.
Right.
A lot of them are setting up real roots, and that will help the schools, and that will help, you know, like all those things that come out of that. So that's a really good sign.
Yeah, and when you talk about Detroit and the loss of population, you have to, you know, zoom out and look at the bigger picture, which is Michigan as a state has lost people.
Right.
And yes, some of that's due to Detroit, but I mean, statewide, we're one of the few states in the U.S. that has been losing population. I don't know if it's the weather, mm-hmm. is if people have finally had it with the stinking weather.
Today's pretty nice.
Today's fantastic. As Arthur P. used to say, 75 rock and roll degrees in the Motor City. Baby! And here comes 30 minutes of between the toes rock and roll. You know, the state and a lot of it has to be, I mean, we have to assume that's related to automotive, right? I mean, there's so many jobs in Michigan connected to automotive and automotive is just scaled down. They're leaner and meaner. There's more automation. Those jobs aren't coming back, yada, yada. We're in the early stages of once again trying to diversify our economy with something else. This time it's high tech. Mm-hmm. But it seems to be really centralized in Detroit. There's some medical technology companies that have come to Michigan. But again, we didn't have the proper skilled workforce ready to take those jobs. They had to hire people from outside Michigan. So still a bunch of those people inside Michigan are still having to leave to find work. I don't know where they're going. I'd love to know. I mean, where do you end up? Because this happens like when a lot of cities, when they start to turn over, New York City was no different. I still can't get an answer to the question, because when Giuliani cleaned up Times Square, because we're getting rid of all the homeless people, like, what do you mean getting rid of? Like, is there an incinerator somewhere underneath City Hall? Because they had to go somewhere. It's like all of Times Square was full of homeless people and prostitutes. And then in a couple of years' time, all gone.
Right.
All gone.
And they seem to appear shortly after Reagan closed a lot of the mental facilities, the mental health hospitals and whatnot. Now, I'm not saying it's a coincidence. Actually, I'm totally saying it's a coincidence because, like, there was at least a place to go. Like, if you were somebody who was struggling to put it together, I mean, I'm not – I don't even want to begin to, like, pretend like I can – talk to people with issues like that, but you at least had you could check yourself in and have a moment. Now it's like when things are down and you're confused and you're done, you just go to the street, you know.
Yeah.
Before there is at least a little bit of a safety net where it would be like, all right, we got you. We're going to figure out what's going on over here, and you know, maybe we can medicate you and at least get you someplace safe and clean to live for a little while. In the 80s, that was no longer the case. But
In Michigan, we put them in prison now. We disbanded our mental health system.
Right.
Again, we never seem to have money for anything, but we raise taxes to fix the roads. But we throw mentally ill people in the prison population.
Right.
That seems cruel and unusual to me, but I, you know –
Well, I mean, we sent a lot of Tomahawk missiles over into Syria, and the result of it looks like 96, maybe 75, if on a bad day. A lot of them missed, but it was $100 million well spent. I'm sure.
I'm sure. And of course, the real meat of that story is what next? It's like, okay, you did that, so the airfield was up and running in a day or two.
Right.
Because the Tomahawks don't really damage the runway so much. They can take out some planes. But so it's like, well, now you've whacked the hornet's nest. You're in a position where you're starting to look like you're opposing Russia.
Mm-hmm.
Now what's the encore for this whole thing?
Yeah. I mean, Assad looked like he was winning the war, so I'm not exactly sure why he would bring out the gas again. But
about a soap opera. I mean, that story's full of crazy characters. But
yeah, I'm just glad to see that he's dealing with the same kind of road conditions that we are now. when he tries to drive one of his planes, pretty similar to what's going on in Michigan. And I think right or left, we can all agree that there's a lot of potholes.
So. Well, it's just the getting back to the jobs thing, you know, it was the only reason that people lived here. You know, I mean, there were a lot of jobs for unskilled people where you could make a good living. You could afford to send your kids to college off what you could make at the factories, which was pretty amazing. You know, I mean, so Michigan people, you know, if you go to the coasts, people cannot understand why anyone would ever live here. It's flyover country, right, for people on the coast.
Despite the fact we have two coasts ourselves.
At least two.
Yeah.
And so now when automotive has finally shrunk, I mean, we went through the bankruptcies during the recession, and now the automakers are making money hand over fist, but the jobs aren't there. And I get it. I don't expect them to be there. I mean, we all know what's going on in manufacturing on a big scale. Doesn't matter what you're making. And you know what? Beyond that. Look at how many office jobs are automated or semi-automated. You know, I worked in the radio industry for a long time. Well, radio is semi-automated these days. I mean, computers are running the music, not a person. Computers are picking the music. Computers are running the commercials. And sometimes the voices aren't even local. The voice has been recorded by somebody in Seattle and flown in over the internet and thrown into the computer, and the listener doesn't even know the difference. You don't even know that you're not even listening to a live local program on the radio because the automation is that good now.
Right. I remember, I think it was the early 80s, there was an episode of WKRP, a show I loved.
Yeah.
And that kind of dealt with that. And that was the early 80s, and they were already using like a cart system or some kind of automated system, and it was the villain of the episode. But it was like, here it comes, you know?
Yeah. And, mechanical automation has been around in radio for decades.
Okay.
And they were big behemoths full of little cartridge tapes. And sometimes the more –
they look like 8-tracks, right?
Yeah, they look like 8-tracks.
Right.
And they could actually be fired off a satellite signal. So you had this giant mechanical behemoth sitting there making clicky-clacky sounds, and the transitions were signaled by the satellite.
Right.
So the dish was on the roof and you had some crude form of automation. Well, computers have made it so much smoother and so much easier and so much better sounding because that old automation would go haywire regularly. Someone had to be nearby when the beast, you know, took a dump on the floor. The automation is out, you know, and then the fixing, you know, it's mechanical versus software. So, people don't even realize this kind of stuff is going on. Jobs that you thought were never going to go away. It's like, well, how can you automate a radio station? Actually, it's pretty easy now. So those jobs, gone, not coming back. And look at what's with office software, database management. What used to take, you know, tons of people a lot of time now is done automatically and quickly by a computer. Don't need as much office staff.
Right.
So everything. I mean,
You know, there's a great example I've been thinking about, and that's security. Security for people, like physical security. Like, you know, normally that's a government job, you know, like to have a good security staff.
Yeah.
But Betsy DeVos, I understand, it cost $1 million a month for taxpayers to provide her for security. Now, I'm not a proponent of people threatening her life. I think that's terrible. I don't think she's qualified, but it cost $1 million to provide her with security. And I was thinking
But you're saying that normally it wouldn't cost that much, but because she's so hated and there are so many threats against her that they're spending more money.
Right. And so, I mean, like, I think as a taxpayer, I feel an obligation that we should protect this. You know, she's a public servant now.
Technically.
Right. But she has a lot of great ideas. I mean, like, have you realized, you know, like teachers, like, you know, they're very wasteful.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, do tell, because I am one.
Well,
so please tell me how I'm wasting everyone's time and money. Geez.
Well, you know, I mean, these teachers, I mean, they bring their own agenda into the classrooms and you know, they get a couple weeks off in the summer and, you know, they, of course, that doesn't mean that they don't have to like grade papers at night on the weeks that they're on the months that they're working, you know, or anything like that. But they have these wonderful privileges that the rest of us don't. And as such, I was thinking that like the private sector could do it better. And the private sector not only could do education better, but the private sector could do security better.
Yikes.
So Betsy DeVos, I mean, I know it's $1 million a month to protect you, but that's a lot of money. And I'm a conservative. I'm a conservative with my money.
Oh,
so
with money, yes.
So I'm thinking that she should probably get a voucher that she could spend on her own private security. And, you know, the taxpayers could fund, you know, instead of $1 million a month, maybe like, you know, $30,000. And she could find her own private security, maybe Mr. T or somebody really intimidating, you know, and that would protect her through these things. I'm sorry. I just had that joke about Betsy DeVos and I just wanted to get it in. Betsy DeVos is costing us a goddamn $1 million a month in security because people hate her so much. And don't threaten her life. That's not good. That's not a good place
to
be.
No, that's nonsense. Right. There's no upside to that whatsoever.
Right. That cost all us. However, let's give her some of her own medicine in form of voucher.
I love
voucher
that.
Voucher medicine.
Yeah.
And so no more public money for you to get your fancy the Secret Service. Could you imagine Secret Service? They're very expensive. We could do better in the private sector, and I think we should with this voucher system. So that was my idea for Betsy.
Fantastic.
So
Mark, we had tried to set up a couple of features for the show today, and we're burning time fast. Do you want to do your news thing?
Yeah, I have a little bit of news stuff. Let me see. The one that I would like to give is some of the listeners know that I write "This Should Be the News" occasionally. So I was going to give you a "This Should Be the Detroit News" segment, if that's okay.
Yeah, you want to do that? Are you ready for it?
Let's make it happen.
All right. So, Mark, take it away.
Wow, how fancy is this?
Let me tell you, Jim. Dan Gilbert announces his plan to make a hybrid jail soccer stadium at the site of the so-called failed jail. Billionaire businessman Dan Gilbert has proposed his updated plans for the unfinished Wayne County fail jail site that will satisfy the county's need for a new jail facility, as well as downtown Detroit's desperate need for a fifth pro stadium. Bedrock officials say the stadium would be made up entirely of the team would be made up entirely of prisoners to keep ticket prices reasonable, and the inmates would also be allowed to fill up the stands when the sales are slow. The team will be called the Car City Jackers, and the stadium will have nods to this criminal theme, like vendors offering lukewarm water, stale bread, and toilet wine. Get your toilet wine to the Jacker fans in the stands. However, Gilbert reassured fans that there will be no fly larva or mice droppings on the food served in the sections without inmates, like will be served in the sections with inmates. Further, the plans, unlike Ford Field, Comerica Park, Joe Louis Arena, Olympia, and Tiger Stadium before it, will bring billions of good-paying jobs, trillions in tax revenue, and a fully functional transit system to Detroit. That was This Should Be the News this week.
Thank you, Mark Pants.
All right, that was a little bit wild, but, you know. Sorry, Wings. I know it's the last day of the Wings tonight. At Joe Louis Arena, and I'm goofing on the new stadium, but let's be honest, they overpromise on these projects.
I hear you. Yeah, and I was just thinking about that because I remember the first band to christen the Joe was Rush.
Nice.
And Rush just helped to induct Yes into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where Geddy Lee is playing bass with Yes and Roundabout on stage. So awesome.
Yes.
Like if I would have been thinking ahead, I would have gone down to Cleveland for that. That was so cool. But, you know, it's boy, these guys are getting up there in age. You know, listening to John Anderson, like, you know, he's trying to maintain that pitch of his voice. But the age, I mean, it's like on the one hand, it's amazing that he's able to do as well as he does. On the other time, on the other hand, I'm thinking you're slaughtering my one of classic this classic song that I love so much.
Well, there's a weird thing like Steve Perry with Journey. I almost respect him for not wanting to sing with Journey. I know part of it is Sour Grapes, but I also recognize that a little bit of it is like he's like I'm not that Steve Perry no more.
No.
I'm not oh Sherry.
He can't wail like that. Who could?
Right. And those are things that we all lose. I mean, like that's a timely thing. Like there's a reason that in the Vatican they hire like children to sing in the choir, you know? Like once you get to a certain age, you know, things change.
Of course they
do. You don't have that same sound. But yeah, I mean, David Letterman introduced Pearl Jam. I read a little bit of the transcript because there's no video of it yet. You know, maybe HBO will have it soon. And I'm a huge David Letterman fan. I'm like David Letterman, Mark. Like I'm
one. Oh, I watched him from the beginning when he had a daytime show.
Oh, I wish I was aware of him back then. Oh,
that was so cool.
Yeah. But like for him to introduce any band and he's got that I don't give an F anymore beard and he's out there and he's like just talking about Pearl Jam. I just can't wait. I can't wait to sit in front of the tube and enjoy it. And I love that those Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction ceremonies.
Yeah. Oh, and Letterman, when he did his final show and the Foo Fighters played and while they ran all those clips – really short clips of the last however many years. Just the whole thing was flying by and the Foo Fighters. Oh, my God. I mean that was an emotional moment. You know, I felt like I'm in the middle of something that's great that's happening right now. It just felt like this timeless, like like the Lions winning the Super Bowl kind of a feeling. You know,
only it's actually possible.
only this was in the real world,
right? Yeah, no, I love that.
So. Well, we're quickly running out of time here, and I wanted to burn off an extra mustard here if I could.
Yes.
So for our listeners that don't know anything about the original Mustard and Onions podcast from years ago that we've resurrected here on Podcast Detroit, we used to do this feature called Extra Mustard, where I take a topic and just kind of dig in and do a little op-ed. So it starts with this. That's your squirt of extra mustard. That's how you know it's coming.
Never wear white.
That sound means it's time for extra mustard. And this week's topic is the radio business. Now, many people seem to think that radio is vanishing, dying, much like good customer service, truth, and coffee-flavored coffee. It's easy to assume that the internet just beat up radio and took its lunch money, right? After all, what purpose does radio serve in a world where we're all married to Jeff Zuckerberg, a jealous partner who can't stand to see us have fun with anyone else? That's a fair question. And to answer it, I'd like to start with newspaper, a medium declared dead years ago. And like Mark Twain, reports of its death were greatly exaggerated. In fact, the New York Times and others have seen an increase in business in spite of being called failing and dishonest by the president himself. Now, I'm not saying that newspapers have a bright and awesome future. Killing trees to print a few more frames of the Lockhorns isn't going to make sense forever. What I am saying is look beyond the outdated technology and see value in the service. The value is in good journalism, not in print on paper. Now, in radio, that service was a local connection not provided by TV or the web and a live human aspect not provided by newspaper. Stations did much more than just play music and announce what rock star was marrying what supermodel. They took part in local events. They raised money for local charities and they gave a voice to their listeners through another ancient technology called the telephone. On top of that, radios have fit in your palm since the 50s with no data limits, no monthly fees, and no invasion of your privacy. Maybe that's why it's still a $15 billion a year business. Yes, that's billion with a B. Now, the technology is old and outdated, but the service provided still has value. Radio is still in every new car that rolls off the line, and not just AM/FM anymore. We now have satellite with over 100 channels where you can hear Howard Stern describe his bowel movements in excruciating detail. So why the premature eulogy for the radio biz? Well, that's easy. There are 152 million blogs on the web, and they need to fill space. If you thought the 24-hour news cycle gave rise to garbage information, make room for the bloated blogosphere, complete with its total lack of credibility, available at no extra charge. Declaring old technology dead is low-hanging fruit for any Dorito-crunching, Red Bull-chugging blogger. They didn't do their homework. In 2015, Forbes magazine reported that radio has seen its highest number of people tuning in ever. 91% of the American public over the age of 12 was using dead technology. I'm assuming the other 9% were Amish or something. So what about the growth of the new digital players in the game? Well, it seems that Pandora and Spotify have their place, but they don't necessarily replace radio, which is the original free music source. And curated playlists? Who do you think invented that idea? Radio. That's what radio is and always has been. A curated playlist based on the musical taste of the audience.
Baby.
And so when you remove the shiny GUI, you find that the web is trying to sell you an idea that was created about 100 years ago. Tons of venture capital went into internet radio during the dot-com boom, and every dollar was set on fire like Detroit during an old-fashioned devil's night. But enough blowing sunshine up the skirt of the radio business. They have a lot to answer for. First of all, they give less to their communities than ever before. They play too many commercials. They do a terrible job of giving new music a chance. They're automating programming and losing touch with the audience. Personality has suffered. If you're wondering who the next Arthur P. or Dick Purton will be, forget about it. There's not going to be one because people with that kind of talent run from radio careers now. The opportunities to be creative are as dead as disco. If you're creative and original, you're better off being a performance artist in a hippie commune because it pays better and you'll actually be appreciated. Radio is vanilla, cookie cutter, and corporate. It used to be the opposite of that. Every city had its own brand of radio, and that was unique to its local culture. Now, none of this may matter, however, as dashboard Wi-Fi gets into the mainstream. What's going to happen to radio in the future when your car drives itself and you've got broadband on board? Squeezing in around a halo on the way to work might just be too hard to resist. On the other hand, radio may be the only sensible option to avoid becoming a country paralyzed by carpal tunnel syndrome. That's extra mustard. Oh. You got a little on you there.
Oh, it's not Maui time.
So true.
Well, I'm out of breath now, which is great because we're out of time.
Well, it's a perfect combination. I wish we still had some of our local radio talent, J.P. McCarthy.
Yeah.
Arthur P.
He's the bomb.
There's so many guys who have come and gone, and some of them are still there.
Yeah, we'll remember Howard Stern used to be a Detroit jock.
Yes.
Steve Dahl, who went on to fame in Chicago, had his time.
He's blown up a disco record or two, I believe.
Well, the thing is that Detroit used to be this magical place. I mean, all the best people in radio did their time here. This was the big time.
Sales. I mean,
went on to have a syndicated show in New York. I mean,
Frank Beckman. Not so much. But,
all right, Mark, we're out of time. Would you hit the social networking and take us out?
Yeah, like I said last week, mustardandonions.com will take you where you want to go. But we also have @mustardpodcast if you want to find us on Twitter or you want to find us on Facebook, and we hope you do. And we hope we talk to you next week. So have a great night.
All right, catch you next time. She was delicious.